morning. I please the court, Rob Carey, on behalf of Biota, and I appreciate that this is the last one. And this, I would rather have been the first one in the new one, but... this case arises out of receiver's recommendation to dispose of Biota's claims for breach of contract and fraud against the alleged wrongdoer, UPS, and the trial court's approach and process in how it handled that receiver's recommendations. The trial court erred in three ways. First, providing the receiver with clear error deference. Second, confirming the decision that the chosen action was valued at zero when there was a $45,000 credit bid and a $250,000 or more competing credit bid. And third, with the establishment of an improper structure and process for how the chosen action would be valued at the hearing. So let me start first with the clear error deference provided to the receivers. I think there's three things there that matter. One is Rule 53 is not an appropriate model for deference.
Excuse me, Mr. Carey, let me interrupt you before you start into the substance of that. UPS said that you didn't preserve that issue, and I noticed that your brief also doesn't have a certificate of compliance indicating that you preserved the issue and indicating where you preserved that issue before the district court. So could you respond to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's in the orders of the court. It's throughout the orders of the court where the court has said, again, I am establishing that it's the clear error standard that shall apply.
But that the fact that the trial court says that that's the standard doesn't show that you objected to that standard.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I think the trial record indicates that that issue was raised numerous times and we had objected to it. There were conference calls with the court, some of which I believe were not recorded, that resulted in those orders. And so it was a very contentious issue that was raised numerous times before the court, and the result that we got was the order.
How would we know that if we don't see those objections in the record?
I suppose I could go and redesignate the conference calls if I could supplement the record, but it may very well be that it's just fundamental error to impose that type of standard for a receiver. It's the highest deference possible, or one of the highest, and there's just no correlation between what a master does and what a receiver does. A court would not get that same deference under Rule 52. So if a court wouldn't get that deference under Rule 52, under Colorado's law, which requires it to only be afforded to testimonial evidence, then there would be no reason that a receiver should be granted a heightened standard over a court. And that's just Rule 52. Rule 53, the parallels aren't there. A master can administer oaths, present evidence, call witnesses, has to file the transcripts with the court and the exhibits, and there's a record that you can review regarding whether the actions were clearly erroneous or not. And I think a lot of the genesis of this arises from the courts and really the receiver's citation to Clark on Receivers, Section 657, where they're referring to a clearly erroneous standard, but that standard is used for a receiver taking care of admitting or paying or denying a claim against the estate, not for valuing a chosen action. And so I don't believe it's an appropriate standard. But moving past that, even if it were, even if you applied the clearly erroneous standard, it's the actions to value the chosen action at zero were clearly erroneous. You had a credit bid from UPS itself, a opening bid of $45,000. It was not countered, it was not negotiated, it was not evaluated in the marketplace. That was followed up by a bid from a outside company, a competing bid for $250,000, and the receiver acknowledged that there was one for as much as $700,000 that was made. Those were not considered. The receiver didn't consider anything related to the value, such as that there's three law firms willing to do it on a no-cost basis to the estate. That there was a walkaway offered by UPS to Biota, which had a value of $9 million.
Did that offer include the guarantor's liability? You say the walkaway?
did it include the guarantor's liability? I believe so. Yes. The $9 million was both parties go their own way, which shows some indication of value. The fact that Morrison Forrester is sending an LA lawyer in to try the case and argue the appeal is an indication of value. And yet, the whole point of the trial court's process and the receiver's process wasn't so much to figure out what the market value of the chosen action was. It was to try to resolve the claims. And that's, again, as a matter of law, that's inappropriate. Under not only amphibious, which is cited in the briefs, but under the Clark on receivers. The court says when you go away from the 657 dealing with how you handle claims against the estate, and you go to how you handle assets, including chosen action, it says you don't need to try to resolve the issue. You need to figure out whether you can take care of it and get some money from it and assign it or litigate it yourself. And so one of the things the receiver did here was completely ignore two things. What the market would have paid for that claim, and two, what the cost would be to the estate. Because the law can't be that the receiver has an obligation to extinguish claims that it thinks is worthless, to guarantee that they will be worthless by getting rid of them before he closes the receivership. And that's exactly what happened here. You have the receiver say, I think this claim is worth zero, and I'm going to give it to UPS not because I think it's worth $45,000. I don't. I think it's worth zero. But because I don't want them to be sued. And so you're essentially switching from a job of maximizing your recovery for the estate to making sure you extinguish all claims before you close the estate down. Because if the claim's worthless and you don't care about it as the receiver, then just walk away and let Mr. Zutler and his brother in Biota pursue their federal court case that was filed, because there's no harm to the estate if you think it's worthless. Or you could do the most sensible thing. Go with a cost-free approach, have it be litigated subject to an equitable lien, that any monies would come back into the estate. You could do a lot of things. You could auction it. You could open negotiations. You could produce some sort of notice. Again, the numbers that I referenced, the $250,000 and the $700,000, $45,000, are all coming from those people in the know. There was never any public notice that this chose was available for sale.
Let me ask you a question, another kind of standard of review question. What you're talking about now is different alternatives that the receiver could have utilized here. Does that take you into not the clear error standard, but abuse of discretion standard? Because what you're talking about is equitable kind of resolutions of the whole matter?
It could. It very well could apply in that. I mean, I think.
Well, is it could or does?
Well, I believe it would be abuse of discretion no matter what, but my point was, even if it's clearly erroneous, I think it violates that. I believe it's clearly erroneous or abuse of discretion across the board and de novo on the legal questions. So, for instance, valuation approaches, I think, are legal questions. The valuation itself is a fact-based question. So the issue of should you, as your approach to determining the value of this chose, should you litigate the forbearance agreement, the breach, and the causation? That's a legal question. And I think the answer to that clearly is no, you shouldn't. You should look at what the market value of the claim is. And that would be de novo, and the factual question would be abuse of discretion. And so I think the...
What about Judge Patrick's finding that there was no forbearance agreement? Isn't that a legal determination?
It is a legal determination, but I would respond this way. There was a $250,000 credit bid. So you can look all day and say, oh, I think the claim's worthless. That's exactly the analysis Amphibious Partner says, don't try to do that.
What do you mean by
a credit bid is, well, UPS's credit bid, well, theirs was $45,000.
And the $250,000 was by a creditor for forgiveness of the Biota's debt for $250,000 to get the claim?
I believe that's what it was. The record's a little unclear. Mr. Cordes said he wasn't sure whether it was a cash bid or credit bid. I think it was a credit bid, but the record's mixed on that.
And it's not documented?
In the record?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, other than Cordes' testimony, there's no written offer?
I don't believe so. Just his testimony that it was made and he rejected it. And he would also have rejected a $500,000 cash offer. So at some point he swung away from trying to maximize the value to the estate into some other purpose. But going back to your question, Judge Taubman, of the judge did find that. But again, the goal here is not to figure out whether you believe plaintiff's witnesses more than defense witnesses or vice versa. The goal is to figure out what, at this point in time, you could get for that chosen action. I mean, I could go through the procedural infirmities of what happened was in the May 4th, 2010 order, the court said, we're going to go in and have a hearing on what the value of the chose is, and it evolved from UPS and the receiver both saying, let's have an auction. It evolved into a hearing on what's the was there a forbearance agreement, was it breached, and what are damages?
But Mr. Carey, isn't the chose of action premised on there being a forbearance agreement?
Well, certainly, but then you get into questions of, for instance, and there are dozens of these. The judge said we have to show an unambiguous agreement from the emails. Well, first, there's the USDA agreement. That alone suffices. There's no requirement under the Colorado Credit Consumer Statute of Frauds that you have an unambiguous agreement. What it says is you can have a commitment, a promise, a financial accommodation, a forbearance agreement that can be enforced if you satisfy it with a writing by the party to be charged. So he set up the wrong standards to begin with, and then he went in and determined credibility of witnesses, like he basically ignored Mr. Crimmins, who was negotiating that week that the default occurred with Nestle. He was negotiating with him, who's a Wall Street executive with Harvard and Yale degrees, who said this impacted our ability to sell this company. And Judge Patrick said, yeah, I don't believe it. I think a due diligence would have revealed the delinquency. Well, first, it wasn't delinquent.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Not believing it and ignoring it are two different things. So not believing it brings into play a credibility determination by the trial judge. Ignoring it is just simply ignoring it. So which was it here?
Well, he said that the problem would have been mooted, essentially, because a due diligence would have determined that the loan was delinquent. But the loan wasn't delinquent at that time if the contract interpretation that we propose is correct. And so, but again, those are the very issues where you're assessing the credibility of Mr. Crimmins or causation effects and saying, I'm going to resolve those against Biota on a summary mini trial rather than a full trial with discovery, where you know what the other side's trying to do, where you didn't have a moving target by the time you get to the hearing, where they're bringing in covenant, loan covenant issues that were never raised before. And so with that, I prefer to reserve the balance of my time.
Very well. Thanks, Mr. Carey.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Greg Colton for UPS Capital. And if it pleases the court, I'd like to start off and just address a few of the statements that Mr. Carey made, just to correct what I believe is not quite accurate reference to the record. First, on the clear error standard, it's exactly right what Your Honor noted, is that Judge Patrick held three separate times at the clear error standard. There was never an objection that was made to that standard. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the documents, the trial brief, the TMO, that's what the defendants argued, the guarantors argued below. If there is a transcript of of one of the telephone conferences we had prior to the hearing, I can guarantee you it does not include any conversation in the clear error standard, because by definition that involves briefing of legal issues, and that I was on all of those calls. They were never discussed. Something that's related to that point, one way that a receiver is different is when a company fails and a receiver is appointed, the receiver comes in and effectively becomes management and starts making decisions with the approval of the court for the corporation. When a corporation is not in default and is in the ordinary course, it's not subject to any kind of supervision from any court, unless it's sued as a derivative claim or whatever. But that's the posture that the receiver sits as an officer of the court running the corporation, and that's why it's appropriate to have a level of deference to the receiver. If you didn't have that level of deference, if it was de novo every time, then what you'd have is the creditors or the shareholders challenging every single decision the receiver ever made under a de novo standard, and the court would never get through a receivership proceeding.
In the context of just basic corporate law in Colorado. You run into this a lot with the business judgment rule.
Yes.
Is that an analogous standard for us to be looking at here? I didn't see that argued in the briefs at all.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there isn't a lot of Colorado law in this, in that context. But if you look at page 39 of the answer brief, we cite some cases just to that effect, where the receiver should get, it's actually a Rhode Island federal case. When receiving, it's Brooke versus Educational Partnership. Well, when reviewing the receiver's petition to settle claims, the court will consider the appropriate factors and give deference to the prudent business judgment of the receiver. And that's, the receiver is often selected because he or she has that kind of expertise, and that's what Mr. Cordes had here. So that's point one. Point two, there's a reference to a credit bid that came from an outside entity. It was not an outside entity. It was a related corporation called Planet Earth First, I think. It was a $250,000 credit bid on an unsecured debt. And it was made way after the fact, after the process had already been established. If that had been made in the early going, it could have been considered. I think it would have been rejected anyway because it was based on unsecured debt that couldn't be confirmed because it was a related entity anyway. But it wasn't made until way after the fact, after the receiver had already made his recommendation and after the court had already set up the structure to evaluate the receiver's recommendation.
What about the guarantor's argument that law firms had indicated to the receiver that they would take the case forward with, at no cost to the estate?
Yeah, what they had offered early on is that they would take the case and but assign all the claims over to the settlers. So they weren't offering value to the state, they were offering value to the settlers. And I think that falls into the category of, under an abuse of discretion standard, the court can consider a range of options. It's not bound by any one option. When Judge Patrick was considering what to do here, he was presented with a number of options. And there wasn't an option presented to him of, we'll have outside lawyers do the case and then we'll pour that value into the estate. The only options that were advanced to him were to option the claim. That's the receiver offered option the claim. I can try to negotiate a settlement. And then the guarantors offered just to take the claim for themselves. And this gets into the standard of review. It is an abuse of discretion. The standard is abuse of discretion. Judge Patrick wasn't bound to take any one option. There could have been several good options here. And if you look at Judge Patrick's final order, he even says that option, yeah, that might have been a good procedure. But what he says is, what I did here is I set up a procedure where I would send the receiver out as my officer, do an investigation and try to figure out if these claims had validity, and then I'll hold a hearing after the fact, and I can see for myself whether these claims have any validity. And mind you, the loan documents here and the guarantee documents have jury waivers. So usually when you see a review or receiver's recommendation, you're on a calendar in a trial court and you're in and out of there in 15 minutes. What Judge Patrick did here is he allowed 3 days of live testimony and let everybody have their say. It was the functional equivalent of having a full-blown trial on the merits. Mr. Zettler got to testify for as long as he wanted. The president of BIOTA, the guarantors called him, Mr. Brown, he testified for a long time. They had the expert come testify, Mr. Crimmins. That was one other issue or point I wanted to correct. From what Mr. Carey said, is that Mr. Crimmins was not involved in the negotiation with Nestle. He did not testify he was involved in the negotiation. He was not involved in the negotiation. To the contrary, he testified that for so long as he was involved in BIOTA, the reason that BIOTA couldn't raise funds is that Mr. Zettler refused to cede 50% of the company, or as much as 50% of the company, and he overvalued the company. So Mr. Crimmins never said anything like that.
But it seems to me there's a fundamentally different concept between what the guarantors say should happen and what you say did happen. But I want to be sure I've got this right. What you say did happen was a valuation of the claims. What are they worth? Okay. What the guarantors seem to be saying is that's not the receiver's role. The receiver's role is to determine what the claims might bring in the marketplace. And it seems to me those are different issues. A lot of people out in the marketplace that buy things that I wouldn't pay you a nickel for. But that doesn't mean that funds couldn't have been raised for the estate by auctions, by negotiating, by counteroffer. I mean, it seems to me, for example, surprising if it's true that the receiver didn't even go back to UPS and say, okay, I'll give you a release for X dollars.
Well, that there was, you mean to negotiate something different than was offered?
I mean, you know, who takes the first offer?
Well, the receiver petitioned the court for instructions. He even proposed, well, should I do an auction? This is on the table, or we could do an auction. And one of the issues here is that UPS had, I think what the court said in its final order, $12 million owed to it. So there was that amount of credit bidding that was going to happen. So if he negotiated up to $500,000 or something like that, it was going to still just be the credit bid. That's all it was going to be. So, and I think that likely influenced his thinking on how it unfolded.
Well, help me understand. Who decided not to auction or otherwise market the claims? Did the court decide that,
yes,
or did the receiver recommend that and the court just bought off on it?
The court decided that. Okay. If you look at the petition for instructions in the record,
Just to be clear. So we're not reviewing a decision of the receiver not to auction the claims. We're reviewing the decision of the court not to auction the claims.
Absolutely.
So there's no question in that of deference to the receiver. We're just reviewing the court's decision.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah, that was put up in the instructions from the receiver, or request for instructions from the receiver to the court. What should I do? Should I auction them? Should I settle them? Should I do something else? And Judge Patrick actually picked a sort of a third ground, which is, well, I want you to go out and investigate them and then report back to me on whether they have any validity. And then I'll hold a trial after the fact.
Well, following up on Judge Webb's questions, and how could Judge Patrick determine whether $45,000 was a fair amount for settlement as opposed to, say, $100,000. Really keeping in mind that, as you say, that he also found that Biota owed $12 million.
Yeah, I think that gets into the merits of the case. And that gets into the deference and the standard review here. Through 3 days of hearing live testimony and reviewing exhibits, Biota was a disaster. If you get into the underlying merits of the claim, there are really three reasons why this claim was never going to get off the ground anywhere. And the first one was that there was no forbearance agreement. If you look at the Univex case, what the Univex case says is Colorado courts are going to interpret the credit statute of frauds in accordance with the intent of the legislature. And that no credit agreement can be implied. And we're going to interpret it in order to prevent uncertainty in credit arrangements. The agreement that the Zettlers, that their case relies on, consists of an email that says, here are the terms we're thinking about. I need your indication that you'll do it so I can go back and get internal approvals and get approvals from the USDA. So there isn't a signed document that follows that. What there are two documents, one from UPS to the USDA and another from the USDA back to UPS. And they have some differing terms. So they're trying to patch together a signed agreement where there isn't one between FIOTA and UPS Capital. Actually, you know, there is one, and that is a formal signed agreement that David Zettler signed that's in the record, but he never returned it to UPS Capital. And that was a formal agreement that completely accords with UPS Capital's version of what the payment deferral agreement was going to be.
Let me come back. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Let me come back to my question, though. So is the clear error deference then applicable to the receiver's conclusion that the claims were worthless? Or again, is that just something the receiver says, I don't have a dog in the hunt? Judge, you decide whether the claims are worthless or not. That's why I keep getting confused, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think the clear error standard is applicable to the factual findings that the receiver made. The findings such as, even if what the guarantors say is true, this business was failing anyway. Or even if what they say is true, they still were in default of their own agreement.
But that all, again, though, that all goes to whether the claim is a winner. It doesn't go to whether somebody in the marketplace may take a flyer and pay money for the claim.
That's right. And on that one, the judge made that decision on his own. I mean, there is a business judgment aspect to this as well, so I guess I would qualify my response. If the receiver is saying, this claim is not worth spending time from the estate to participate in the litigation, provide documents, so forth, all of these things, this claim is a dead loser, then I think there's some business judgment that's due the receiver on that.
Isn't that still an entirely different question from saying, you know, what would some gambler or gambling law firm pay for the claim if they were given an opportunity to buy it?
Well, it's a different route.
Okay, well, I mean, as a matter of law, why is the approach taken by the receiver and the court to value the claim, as opposed to the approach urged by the guarantors, is to go in the marketplace somehow,
right,
and see what the claim will buy? Why is the trial court's approach, not the conclusion, approach correct as a matter of law, and the guarantor's approach is incorrect?
Because in addressing how to deal with a receivership estate and making those decisions on how to proceed with a receivership, the trial court's decision is subject to an abuse of discretion standard.
And you're saying there's no black and white legal rule out there that says you value the claim or you go to the marketplace and see what somebody's going to pay for it?
Oh, there's absolutely no black and
okay.
white rule.
All right.
There is a tremendous discretion okay. in how to approach it.
And that's what we're really reviewing then, is the trial court's discretionary decision to go with the valuation approach.
Absolutely. And the cases are all about discretion, not only in what you choose to do with your claim, or how the ultimate decision, but how you structure the process. And if you look at the process that Judge Patrick structure here, it had a lot of safeguards, including a three-day trial at the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Colton.
Thank you. First, the two propositions that Mr. Colton just mentioned, you had a full trial, it's as if you had a full trial, you got all the things, well, except with no discovery and a limited basis to trial on. Other evidence was excluded, and that issue, and then sending the claim to UPS, both of those violate amphibious partners and those types of cases. That's exactly what they say courts shouldn't do. You shouldn't send it to the person who's not going to litigate it. Don't give that party the claim. Send it out and let it be litigated and let it have a chance of bringing money into the estate. The deference issue, again, whether it's the business judgment rule, whether it's abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous, it was violated when he said it's zero. It can't be zero. They got $45,000 for it. They could have gotten more for it. It has to be worth something. And the issue on whether it was the court or the receiver who decided to settle the claim, the court said, look, well, first, let me back up one second. Both the receiver and UPS said, we're doing an auction. We're doing an auction. Then the court, in one of its orders where it's setting down the procedure for how this is going to happen, said, you can auction it or settle it. Then they ran off and immediately agreed to settle. The court didn't say, oh, yeah, okay, I'm thinking settlement here, not auction. That's not what happened. The court said you can do either. And then they determined that they would do a inter-party settlement for a credit bid of $45,000, and then they notified UPS or Bayada. Mr. Cordes, speaking of the deference to him, he has no expertise. He had no idea what the legal claims were about or how they should be evaluated. He's not a lawyer. He's never valued claims. The only time he's ever had any experience whatsoever was buying a chosen action at an auction, which turned out the opposite way than he thought. He's not a master who has some special expertise in buying claims out in the marketplace. He's an accountant and a receiver. And that his job is to handle the estate's assets. And when you get into something like this, this is precisely why Amphibious Partner says, tread carefully here, because courts aren't really designed to go out and value contentious cases and say, here, this is worth something or it's not worth something. It's even worse when you have a receiver who has no legal training making those exact same decisions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. I want to thank the lawyers who have traveled from outside of Denver for the oral arguments this morning. We do appreciate both of your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.